Al Jazeera Podcasts.
The time is now. Anthony Blinken striking an urgent tone in his attempts to get a ceasefire in Gaza. America's top diplomat says a strong proposal is on the table as he makes his seventh visit to the Middle East since fighting began in October. That's as indirect negotiations for a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas carry on in Egypt. But questions are being raised about the chances of reaching an agreement after Israeli Prime Minister reiterated his plan to invade Rafah. Can Benjamin Netanyahu's threat disrupt talks to end the war? I'm Nick Clark, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyze, and help define major global stories. So plenty to take on. Let's bring in our guests. Joining us from London is Daniel Levy. He's president of the US Middle East Project and a former Israeli negotiator. Nora O'Day is a political analyst. She joins us by Skype from Amman. And joining us by Skype from Washington, D.C. is William Lawrence. He's a professor at American University and a former US diplomat. A warm welcome to each of you. So, as negotiations continue, I'm wondering what the motivation is for Benjamin Netanyahu, Daniel Levy, to say that he will invade Rafah, ceasefire or no ceasefire. Does he mean it? How can there be a ceasefire and a wholesale attack on Rafah? Daniel, over to you.
The simple answer, Nick, is those two things cannot go together. And to the extent to which there was some sense maybe this prolonged impasse in the mediated talks could be found a way out of, precisely because, for the first time, there was a sense that maybe the US was leaning into the idea of a permanent rather than a temporary ceasefire, and that would allow Hamas to move the negotiations forward from their side. To the extent to which it looked possible, Prime Minister Netanyahu just took a saw to that. He just chopped that off at the knees because by insisting that a rougher operation would go together, would continue no matter what, Netanyahu was conscious of what he was doing and he was yet again trying to undermine the talks. But what's important to acknowledge here, Nick, is he was doing so because he felt confident. He had already heard the American side say, it's a generous offer. Hamas, over to you. If this doesn't happen, there's only one party to blame. So Netanyahu was essentially let off the hook yet again by an American president, an American secretary of state, an American administration who have allowed this war to continue, who have provided the weapons. And Netanyahu is in no hurry. For him, a long war, a forever war, is politically beneficial. And I do think one should take the Israeli Prime Minister seriously. I do think the preparations are being made for Rafah. I do not think there is an IDF consensus. But if Netanyahu has his way and he is not stopped, then the over 1 million Palestinians in Rafah are going to face what is going to be, one can imagine, yet another horrendous violation of international law, devastation, killing. And, you know, that is going to happen if something else doesn't intervene. And Blinken just blew the chance.
Right. Can something else intervene? William Lawrence, what do you think? Netanyahu let off the hook? And if so, what are the implications for any ceasefire deal?
Well, I agree grosso modo with what Daniel's saying. I don't think he's entirely off the hook. I still think that the U.S. pressure's quite intense. I think there's many flaws in the negotiation here, both the public and the private part. One is this idea of a permanent ceasefire. That's called a peace treaty or an armistice, and that doesn't exist. It's not even really on the table. And now that's why we're seeing phrases like sustainable calm and, you know, longer cessation of hostilities for a year, formulas within which that could be pressured. And if you parse Netanyahu's statements since early February, you know, when this was first proposed and the Rafah operation was first delayed, he leaves wiggle room. He'll say things like, well, I won't be forced into something I don't agree to. But then he implies if he agreed to something, then, you know, he could be given another way out, which is the Americans made me do it. There's also a problem here that Israel is operating as if Hamas is in a very weak position, which they don't believe they're in. Hamas believes the U.S. The Israeli side is in a very weak position because of the protests in the United States and other things. And operating, negotiating on that basis isn't really going to get us to an outcome. I think the latest proposals are promising and not impossible. This sort of dance that's going on where Hamas goes to Cairo and leaves and the Israelis go to Cairo and leaves is not good. I was hoping this week they'd all be in one place and maybe Bill Burns would show up. I heard that technical negotiations will shift to Doha tomorrow. But this isn't over yet. One way that, one commentator here in the U.S. phrased it is Netanyahu has a choice between Rafah and Riyadh. And all of the meetings in Riyadh and all of that effort to sort of offer Netanyahu a big normalization, not only with Saudi Arabia, but much of the rest of the Muslim majority countries, which would follow, is not off the table yet. That package is still being discussed, right, along with the day after proposals that are going on.
Sure. And Noor, do you think Hamas would agree to this so-called prolonged period of quiet, given what Benjamin Netanyahu is saying about invading Rafah, whatever happens?
I think Hamas finds itself in a difficult position because the mediators, whether it's Egypt or Qatar, have put all their weight behind these latest efforts to reach a ceasefire. The situation on the ground is untenable. You have the whole population on the brink of famine. You have an impossible situation where more than a million people, nearly a million and a half people, are supposed or expected to be crammed in an area with absolutely no services or infrastructure to offer, which is called al-Mawasi. It doesn't fit them. It cannot accommodate them. And everybody knows what a Rafah invasion would mean. But on the other hand, I think it's important to also note that Hamas also has to speak to its own constituents. It cannot be seen as surrendering. It cannot be seen as accepting anything that is on the table, especially in light of what it heard and what the whole world heard from Netanyahu, promises of continuous war, of almost endless war, and seeking the decimation of the enemy. We're almost, in an exchange that belongs somewhere in medieval times, where you have one power that goes against, at war, and they want complete and absolute surrender. I think the adults at the table should understand by now that that's not going to happen. But I find that one of the things that perhaps is keeping negotiations back is the fact that the Americans haven't completely let go of the idea that they can deliver to Netanyahu and to Israel a victory through these talks, through normalization with Saudi Arabia, while at the same time promising a political horizon for Palestinians. So in a way, canceling out a major Palestinian player while claiming that this would ultimately be positive for the Palestinians. And I think that is one of the reasons why you have a stop-and-go dynamic at this point, even though you have this big carrot of normalization with Saudi hanging in the distance.
Yeah, stop and go is the phrase, isn't it? Daniel, so, as Noor says, it's a difficult position for Hamas, but let's just say Hamas do agree, where does that then leave Benjamin Netanyahu? Because he can't then go into Rafah, can he? Or does he just wait?
No, I think Prime Minister Netanyahu knows that he can create the conditions whereby there can be no Hamas agreement. Hamas will not go into a ceasefire if Prime Minister Netanyahu is promising that after a few days of calm, we are going to make the hellscape even worse. And the American sponsors of Israel are blaming Hamas, saying, well, we don't think you should do Rafah quite that way, unless there is an unequivocal American willingness to say, this is, as William said, a sustainable calm, whatever language you want to say, there will be no Rafah, full stop. We are the guarantors. If that is not said, then I do not think there is the prospect of an agreement. Prime Minister Netanyahu knows that. That is why he has positioned himself in the way he has. But Prime Minister Netanyahu doesn't want to take the blame. There's a poll in the Israeli media today which says that the Israeli public would support by 47 to 32, the rest of don't knows, a deal that involved the release of the hostages, a permanent end to this war, and the release of thousands of Palestinians, they call them terrorists, Palestinians held in Israeli prison. He knows that there is not a consensus around Rafah. He knows that within his own military, there are reservists who have said they will not show up because of burnout. He knows that 400 families of soldiers in regular duty have written to Gantz and Eisenkot in the war cabinet to say, if you go into Rafah, it's the end of the hostages. Please withdraw from the government if that's the proposal. So there's internal pressure. He needs a way out from that internal pressure. The way out from that internal pressure is to blame Hamas. And rather than making this harder for Netanyahu, it does seem that the Secretary of State and the President have just given Netanyahu his get out of this card, which for him is, of course, also a get out of jail free card, because he is, after all, still a prime minister in court who, for his political survival, needs the continuation of the war.
Right. Now, the international community, of course, has made its position clear. President Biden has said the invasion of Rafah is a red line. Not easy to see how the Israeli offensive on Rafah could be compliant with international law, so says the UK Deputy Foreign Minister Andrew Mitchell. France has weighed in too. The UN Secretary General has said also there's an assault on Rafah would be an unbearable escalation, appealing for all those who have influence over Israel to do everything in their power to prevent it. So that's a general view internationally. William Lawrence, first up, what does President Biden mean when he says it's a red line? Can he bring any more pressure to bear? What if Netanyahu did go into Rafah? Would he do anything?
Well, as one senior Qatari negotiator told me, if the Americans put in 20% more pressure on Israel, this thing would have already been over. But let's talk about Rafah for a minute. The Americans keep saying no but. And the but means protection of the 1.5 million civilians in and around Rafah. And the way to sort of see where that's going is the 40,000 tents for 400,000 people, which began to be built north of Rafah and then doesn't seem to have gone any further. The Israelis are telling the Americans nothing would happen until after Passover, and it would be 2 to 4 weeks to move everyone out before the ground invasion. The Americans are saying it should take more like 3 to 4 months to move everybody. And then this gets to another thing a Qatari negotiator told me. He said this is basically about hostages, prisoners, and troop movements. And when he says troop movements, he means where do the Israelis pull back to? And the latest offer was sweetened with a pulling off the Netzarim corridor, which divides North and South Gaza, and the opening of those two rows of the main roads that go north-south in Gaza, and also a big movement of population back towards the north, which would presumably need to be supported by the new $230 million pier being built, largely because the Israelis won't let in aid, despite all of the arm-twisting America says it's doing on the aid. And so all of that suggests to me that things aren't as imminent on Rafah as they keep saying. Blinken did say again the day before yesterday, there's no plan we've seen. Austin testified the same thing yesterday. So the Americans are not signing off on Rafah and would want a massive protection of civilians we haven't seen yet. So in essence, the Americans have kind of boxed Netanyahu in without anyone really recognizing it or giving them credit for it. They're basically saying ceasefire or Rafah operation in a way you've never done any of this operation. And that's something that Netanyahu's having a hard time swallowing. And that's one of the reasons we're also at this impasse.
Nora, I'm going to throw it to you now for any comment off the back of that. But I just want to say this, that the UNA chief, Martin Griffiths, said that the simplest truth is that a ground operation in Rafah will be nothing short of a tragedy beyond words. Nora.
Absolutely. I think it would be apocalyptic. I mean, we've seen the scenes of the aftermath of ground invasions in Khan Yunis, in al-Nusayrat, in Gaza City, in Beit Lahia. And they are scenes of utter decimation. Fast forward 6 months, where you have an entire population that is malnutrition, that is fatigued, that has lost loved ones, that knows there's no way out. There is no hospitals to go to even. And you've got yourself a combination that no amount of aid can possibly ameliorate or make better, let alone the fact that aid would be very difficult to come in and so on. But I think what's really interesting right now about all of these statements we're hearing from Blinken or from Washington is just how elastic those American red lines have proven to be. And we've seen Netanyahu push the boundaries time and again since October. We've seen him test the Biden administration's willingness to use the stick instead of the carrot. And every time he's come out on top, even when it comes to the application of U.S. law regarding, you know, allies that violate human rights, regarding the Leahy law, regarding settler attacks, regarding the attacks on humanitarian aid workers, and so on. So I think in many ways, Netanyahu feels that no matter how much he kind of turns his back to the Biden administration, given the fact that this is election season, given the fact that Biden is so ideologically married to the idea that there can be no daylight between Israel and the United States, that basically Netanyahu will get away with whatever he wants. He's more focused on keeping his coalition and, as Daniel said, on staying in power, on staying out of jail. So if it takes taking the Americans by surprise and going into Rafah, I think he will do it. And that's, I think, where all the panic, the justified panic on the ground in Gaza lies, the knowledge that Netanyahu can get away with it and that people have to figure out where they will go, which, you know, over which rubble they will set up the tent now.
Daniel, over to you with this question. Benjamin Netanyahu says it's all about finishing off Hamas. First of all, do you think that's possible? Because many of the group's prominent leaders, including Yair Sinwar, are believed to be still alive and are believed to be there, but nobody knows for sure where, if they are. And secondly, how disabled is Hamas from your perspective?
It's a nice narrative for Netanyahu to have. As I've said, I don't think he's in any hurry to do Rafah. I think he has a problem, because if he does go into Rafah, he can't tell that story anymore. He can't say, well, now when we do Rafah, we'll actually have eradicated Hamas. This has been 6 months where it's not gone that well on the battlefield for Israel. So Hamas has quite effectively used its asymmetric capacities. Of course, it's been devastating for the Palestinians inside Gaza, but the military themselves do not have a consensus around Rafah, because they will also no longer have a story to tell. The myth of Israeli invincibility was shattered on October the 7th. The army can still say, well, if we'd been allowed to do Rafah, then we really could have finished this job, but pressure meant we couldn't. Go into Rafah and you are going to have, and this is what some of the military commentators and some of the leaks have told us, that they're not looking forward to that. They know that some very unpleasant, let's say, fighting awaits the Israeli military in Rafah. So no, Hamas will not be eradicated. Netanyahu will not have his total victory. When it was the six-month anniversary, many of the Israeli military commentators were saying this looks more like total defeat than total victory. He needs to pump this up, but I don't think there is a belief that this can be done. I think the Americans have tried to say, can we give you more goodies? Can we sweeten the pot with a deal with Saudi Arabia? And I think Netanyahu has looked at this and said, it's not a Riyadh or Rafah. I want both, please, Mr. President. And if it's not you who gives me both, someone else will give me both, just as I got Al-Quds and Abu Dhabi. I didn't have to choose between the two of them. I could maintain all of the occupation and get normalization elsewhere. And that's what I expect here. And so Netanyahu, I don't want to suggest that he feels everything is in his corner. He has felt certain pressures. But unfortunately, every time the Americans could have put the lever that matters most to him, which is the continued convoy of weapons to continue this war, they chose not to, and I don't see any change in that.
Noor, we're coming towards the end of the programme. I want to shift tack just very slightly. What about Egypt? What's Egypt's role in all of this? How worried would Egypt be about a potential Israeli invasion of Rafah?
Egypt should be and is, I think, very worried about an invasion of Rafah. This is a threat to its national security. Egypt is the country bordering Gaza. It cannot be seen as shooting at Palestinians seeking refuge and safety in a fellow Arab country, but at the same time, it does not want to go down in history as the country who allowed or facilitated the expulsion of Palestinians yet again from their homeland. And so Egypt, I think, will do whatever it can to push things towards an agreement, even if it were, half good agreement, whatever kind of agreement that can be reached momentarily, hoping that that could kind of snowball into something more significant. But for Egypt, this is a threat right at its doors, and it has to do something in order to at least justify where it stands to its constituents, to its people, and not look like a sellout.
William, big protests going on in the United States. Al Jazeera, we've been covering all sorts of protests happening at universities, as it is right now. So if there was an invasion of Rafah, what would the implications of that be on the numbers turning up at those protests and the potential for that getting more out of hand if Israeli troops do go in? And the implications, of course, as Daniel's referenced, in this election year with President Biden going to the polls in November.
I think it would be quite massive. I think we're getting close to 10% of all American four-year colleges having major protests, and the numbers are just growing with each unnecessary police action. I haven't said there's a few police actions that may be necessary, but most of them are just applications of state violence for no good reason, and it will continue to grow. I think there's been mistaken analysis that this is going to force Biden in any palpable way. I think what's actually happening is now that progressive voters and Arab and Muslim leaders are saying they would never, ever, ever vote for Biden. That's pushing Biden back to the center, the Haley voters and all that. And I don't think the protests will massively affect Biden's decision-making. But the general position of Americans now and of the Democratic Party is this needs to end immediately. If I could just add one thing to Nora's answer, Egyptians have threatened to suspend this peace treaty, which would be pretty important, and the way that border's managed. And there was a terrible article in Foreign Policy saying that Egypt needs to take in the refugees, which is a non-starter given the history of 48 and 67 of the Gaza population. But I really do believe, if I could just add one more point, that there's a proof of concept here that American pressure can work. It works to force the November 24 ceasefire. It forced the Israeli response to Iran to be less. It forced the Israelis at one point to quadruple the aid going in, although it's woefully insufficient. And it delayed the Rafah operation by 3 months now. So there's American pressure can work, and Americans just have to push just hard enough, as the Qataris said, to force Netanyahu into this ceasefire. And it can be done if it's done in the right way.
Daniel, can American pressure work? Here's a question for you. Spin forward 3 months. Where do you reckon we'll be then?
I think we will be probably with Israeli troops in Rafah doing their worst. We're in the summer. Heat is a factor. The famine, spread of disease, humanitarian crisis is not going to go away. I think we'll all be waiting with some real interest as to what the Democrat convention in Chicago is going to look like. I hope that's not where we are. I do not think the Americans have pushed off Rafah. I think Netanyahu has been in no hurry. I think his military was not ready for it. And I also would not discount that Netanyahu still has other war-making options with Hezbollah in the north, and the file on the escalation with Iran is not yet closed. But crucially, I would say Israel would be ill-advised to continue to test its military-only path in the region, because it is, I would argue, storing up some very, very serious future problems for itself at home, in the region and internationally. Those don't play out according to an American electoral calendar of a few months, though.
All right, we've run out of time. We'll have to leave it there. Daniel Levy, Nora Day and William Lawrence, thank you very much for joining us here on Al Jazeera on Inside Story. This episode was produced by Shantanu Chatterjee, Katia Lopez-Horian, Michael Harwood and Paul Taylor. Studio sound was by Alexander Chigreen, and the program was edited by Venetia Velilath, Linton Gwynn and Joe DeFries. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thanks for listening. Tune in on Thursday for our next edition.
Coming up on The Take, we speak to Maryam Saeed, Columbia University graduate and wife of the late literary critic Edward Said, on the protests happening now. That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.